Afterword to the Vintage Edition, 2012, by Douglas Rushkoff. The first edition of The Image was published in 1962, the year after I was born. John Kennedy was yet to be assassinated, LSD was yet to reach Harvard University, and the French postmodernists were yet to begin their deconstruction of America's television-driven culture. Ironically, perhaps, like most readers coming to the book today, my main access to the sensibility of this era comes from television shows such as Mad Men, which, for all its slick characters, cigarette smoking, and cynical dialogue, actually depicts a kind of innocence. The last moment in our history before the images created on Madison Avenue overtook reality. From our current perspective, within the chaotic onslaught of tweets, status updates, and social marketing, the discussions between ad men about what slogans might best sell pantyhose seem almost quaint. Though rather devious in its intent, there was an art to the manufacturing of images that could touch the untapped recesses of human psychology. This was a craft that could be mastered by one set of human beings to influence the behaviors of another. Our widespread fascination with this era, with its styles, appliances, and values, points to our own sense that something has been lost since then. Yes, the triumphant post-war American narrative was irreparably interrupted by a series of brutal assassinations, the Vietnam War, and the massacre at Kent State. But if we reach back just a bit further than this, to the time of Pan Am, the World's Fair, and the Dick Van Dyke Show, we find an America already undergoing a deep radical transition from one culture into another, from what Boorstin would consider the world of language and text to the world of the image. A conservative at heart, Boorstin saw this as a shift away from considered thought to one of superficial understanding. While words take time to utter and hear and require attention to parse their meaning, the impact of the image is instantaneous, its influence decadent. Before the primacy of the image, a salesman or advertisement would have to describe the attributes of a product in a rational appeal to the intellect. Afterward, it was the mythology of the brand, usually concocted by psychologists, that would sway a consumer's heart. Likewise, with the rise of the image in politics, the policy platform of a presidential candidate would come to matter less than the ability of his image to convey ineffable or irrelevant values. Though Boorstin introduces this idea in relation to the Nixon-Kennedy presidential debates in 1960, in which the telegenic Kennedy came off the victor, this new media reality ultimately served the left no better than it did the right. Reagan would come to depend even more on the intentional manipulation of visual imagery than Kennedy did, and modern conservatives have learned to exploit the thought-quelling immediacy of television as well as any liberal Democrat has. Where Boorstin proved the most prophetic and relevant to our age, however, is in his prediction about the extent to which manufactured imagery would be able to supplant reality itself. In a process he saw as beginning in his own time, the imagery that was being created, as well as the media that was used to disseminate it, began taking on lives of their own. That's why the era of the Mad Men is so intriguing, even nostalgic for us today. There were still human beings utilizing their creativity. The Mad Men were actively concocting the logos of banks, the brand myths of soaps, and the characters on cereal boxes. There was a creative innocence fueling all this cultural production and reproduction, and a real excitement about the potential of the new technologies. The magic of color TV would be as spectacular as the race into space. But as Boorstin had begun to observe, the novelty of television was soon superseded by its ubiquity. The hypnotic lure of these simulated realities became the seamless wash of Muzak and strip malls. Innocence and awe was giving way to sensory overload and unconsciousness. As Baudrillard would later explain, we lost touch with any of the creative origins of these media as the simulations they rendered became the new reality. The first symptoms of this cultural disconnect appeared to Boorstin as the precursors to a much greater disease of widespread self-deception and discontent. Unlike Marshall McLuhan, who would later codify these changes in less judgmental terms, such as hot and cool, or obsolescence and retrieval, Boorstin made no secret of his concern and disdain for the direction in which the American experience and its discourse were going. Most famously, he coined the term pseudo-event as a way to describe the public relations-driven, over-dramatized media moment. He saw events and ideas enjoying dissemination and attention based on little more than their appropriateness to a sensationalist media. These synthetic events distracted us from the issues that mattered and recast everything in the language of image. He feared presidential debates becoming too much like quiz shows, and coverage drifting from issues that matter to discussions of the candidates' television performances. The pseudo-event highlights only pseudo-qualifications. He worried about the tendency of Hollywood to recycle the stories of novels, creating the illusion that the forms were interchangeable and that people could truly get the gist of a book simply by seeing the movie. What might Boorstin say of today's college students who get the gist of Hamlet by reading a two-paragraph summary on sparknotes.com? And while movies are capable of representing panoramic sweeps and many kinds of spectacle, they are generally limited to speaking out on issues. Novels, on the other hand, have the ability to speak in and address a more interior drama by engaging with individual readers' minds over longer periods of time. In a world dominated by the image instead of the word, interior life gives way to exterior show. Substance gives way to simulation. Pseudo-events in turn give rise to a new kind of celebrity, people who are famous for being famous. Boorstin was thinking of the Hollywood star system, how it manufactured types whose very casting in a part communicated pretty much everything one needed to know about the character. But he was also getting at least a vague premonition of most of today's reality television, where any sort of talent is not only superfluous, but actually a hindrance. The kids on MTV's Real World, for example, excel most for their ability to behave like real-world cast members. The real-world season, like that of any other reality show, is itself a pseudo-event, absolutely manufactured and all the more successful for its refusal to do anything other than be itself. On such a pseudo-stage, celebrity becomes not just what Boorstin called a self-fulfilling prophecy, but a self-referential vacuum. The purity of celebrities is measured and confirmed through their ability to prove their incompetence in all real things. Paris Hilton, for example, is famous precisely because she is not qualified to do anything other than be famous. Her hit reality TV series followed her and her friend through America as they failed at doing basic tasks, either through laziness or incompetence. Likewise, Charlie Sheen reaches the high point of his own celebrity not by performing well on his television sitcom, but by sharing his manic delirium with the world through social media. Even his fictional television role was more a tongue-in-cheek comment on his pseudo-event real-life debauchery than an acting performance. Although Boorstin predated the net, he did foresee the direction in which we were going, and longed to alert us to both the humanity and intellect we would be destined to leave behind as we leaped headlong in a world of image. What he may not have realized, however, is the extent to which the emergence of peer-to-peer networking technologies might eventually challenge the preeminence of the image factory from which he recoiled. By making images for one another instead of just consuming those of corporate America, we could begin to reverse the process through which we are, in Boorstin's words, being programmed by advertisers. He also seemed somewhat oblivious to the role of the market economy in fueling all this image-making and meaning-taking. As we understand now, media does not act independently of other social institutions, but is part of a greater ecology of forces and technologies. Television did not cause the pseudo-event any more than Facebook caused the Arab Spring, even though the biases of these media types certainly contributed to the kinds of outcomes they yielded. In the case of America in 1962, corporate capitalism was understood as a given. The only question at the time was what might be the best method for promoting its values and products to America. The advertisers of Madison Avenue believed they could create a mythical landscape in which brands and consumption would feed both our corporate coffers and our unconscious desires. Boorstin saw such efforts as not only dangerous, but also an admission of defeat. Why do we need the lies of an advertising industry unless we are covering something up? By surrendering to the disingenuous image maker, we were acting as if we had something to hide. In hindsight, perhaps we did. Whether or not a truer American dream may have been realized without the manipulations of the advertising industry, there is little doubt that we descended into a dream nonetheless. It was a dream we built ourselves in a spirit of optimism and infinite possibility, from Detroit to Levittown, in offices and bedrooms furnished by Eames and Haywood Wakefield, and televised by NBC and Philco. If we are inclined to look back at that era with fascination and longing, it may be less for the mid-century furniture and fashions than to comprehend the consciousness with which they were created and used. Those last wonderful moments before we drifted off to sleep. This book is one of the clearest missives we have from the other side of that dream. It was a dream into which Boorstin saw us drifting, and a dream from which he was imploring us to wake. By reckoning with this analysis of how we were lulled to sleep, we may finally stand a chance of rousing ourselves into consciousness again. Douglas Rushkoff, Hastings on Hudson, 2012. Douglas Rushkoff is a media theorist and the author of Program or Be Programmed, Life, Inc., Media Virus, and Coercion. He made the television documentaries Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation, and is the winner of the Media Ecology Association's Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman Awards. This concludes the reading of The Image, 50th Anniversary Edition, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America by Daniel J. Boorstin. Copyright 1961 by Daniel J. Boorstin. Forward to the 25th Anniversary Edition, copyright 1987, by Daniel J. Boorstin. Afterward copyright 2012 by Douglas Rushkoff. This book was read by Tim Danko. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Vintage Anchor Publishing, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.